places. Everyone.
We're now broadcasting.
Roll the tape in. 3, 2.
A new audio drama.
Appaloosa Radio is where stories come alive.
Appaloosa Radio offers an original audio drama, Special Monkey Magic, featuring Jiminy, the Organ Grinder's Monkey, Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago.
In October 1934, during the very worst of the Great Depression, Jiminy, the ever-inquisitive Organ Grinder's Monkey, died. He died because the company that his three creators had founded to give Jiminy things to get into had failed. The Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago was no more. To say that a cartoon character died is not really accurate. To die means that you once were alive. Some would argue that Jiminy was just some India ink on a sheet of transparent celluloid. He did not have blood or lungs or a heart. He only did what his animators made him do. He had no will of his own. Lef, who preferred to be called Alec, Hugh, and Charles, would strongly disagree with those folks. Jiminy may have not had a heart or lungs or blood, but they would each attest that Jiminy most definitely had a will of his own. He had strong opinions, strong likes, and equally intense dislikes. Alec was tasked with creating Jiminy's facial expressions. In four strokes of a pen, a spot of India ink became a face with all of emotional range of a human. Some days, Jiminy told Alec exactly what he was feeling before Alec had completed his second stroke with the pen. "Show me," Alec would assertively say, "that Jiminy does not know what he is feeling. He knows even before I pick up the pen." Hugh drew the backgrounds, the places where Jiminy would be loose to explore and to do his inquisitive exploration. Every morning, Hugh would begin by asking Jiminy where he wanted to go today. "What mischief do you want to get into?" Then, Hugh would create those places, exactly according to Jiminy's request. Charles was the best pure artist of the trio. He had studied the way bodies move, how limbs shift according to the situation. He used that knowledge to create a body for Jiminy that was both very realistic, and, yet, very simple. During the First War, when he was flying French aeroplanes, Alec had gained a taste for philosophic discourse. That taste grew to be a passion while Alec endured the long months of rehabilitation from the loss of his left leg. He would argue basic philosophic principles with his doctors, the blessed sisters who nursed his wounds, and his fellow patients. On multiple occasions, he had pontificated that Jiminy was an engaging and lively character who existed beyond the stroke of India ink that drew him.
"Not to play a silly game of semantics, but it is wrong to say that the animator created the character. No, what the animator does is to assist the character to come into life. Like waking from a coma. The character was already alive. The animator wakes him up. The artist gives the character an anima. Anima, in Latin, meant soul or essence of being. The artist gives a group of lines an anima. He gives these lines their essence of being. Jiminy is as alive. as alive as you or me.
Still, in October 1934, Jiminy, the ever-inquisitive organ grinder's monkey, died. He died when the Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago ceased its operations. This is a quiz. What do the following have in common? Gertie the Dinosaur. Mutt and Jeff. Heckle and Jekyll. Betty Boop. Popeye. Woody Woodpecker. Felix the Cat. Superman. Mickey Mouse. Jiminy, the organ grinder's monkey. Coco the Clown. I will give you a hint. All were important movie stars, whose motion pictures were seen in thousands of theaters. Here is another list. How many of these men do you recognize? Emil Kahl, Winsor McKay, Raoul Barre, Bill Nolan, Frank Moser, Gregory LaCava, Vernon Stallings, Tom Norton, Pat Sullivan, John Bray, Earl Hurd, Paul Terry, Max Fleischer, David Fleischer, Walter Lantz. The men on the second list created the characters on the first list. The first list was of cartoon characters initially created during the two decades before 1934. 1934 was a seminal year for cartoon animation in America. Between 1929 and 1934, 10 of the country's largest and oldest animation studios were forced to close. By 1934, nearly all cartoons were produced in Hollywood by four giant cartoon factories. Warner Brothers, who made Looney Tunes. MGM Swell made Terry Toons. Walt Disney Studio. And Screen Gems. Each of these factories produced cartoons in an assembly line operation, with specialists each doing only a specific part. Their output was tremendous. For example, from 1931 to March 1934, the Walt Disney Studios produced 65 different Mickey Mouse cartoons. The older, independent animation studios just could not compete. One of the reasons that the older, independent studios lost out was because their characters were largely created before sound movies. They continued to use old slapstick gags, while the industry now relied on dialogue, music, and sound effects. Another, more sinister reason was that the major Hollywood studios used their exclusivity agreements to drive the independent animation studios from the movie theaters. It was such an agreement that killed the Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago. At its height, Carousel Cartoon distributed to 129 theaters, primarily in the Midwest, but also dipping down into Central Texas. However, when the major Hollywood studios began strictly enforcing their exclusivity agreements, the company was left with only two theaters, both within walking distance of the Chicago studio. Both theaters were owned by longtime personal friends. Unfortunately, the guys at Carousel Cartoon were frozen out of the market. The Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago existed barely 4 years, making 26 six-minute cartoons. 17 of those cartoons featured Jiminy the always impulsive and inquisitive organ grinder's monkey. Four of the Carousel cartoons featured Scary, the dancing scarecrow, whose audience was beginning to build. They also tried a tugboat, who could not swim, and a taxicab, that was always getting lost, but neither character stayed in their repertoire. Their initial sound cartoon featured a yodeling cowboy. Hugh always said that, by far, the worst cartoon that the Carousel Cartoon Company ever made was its very experimental, The Farm at Sunrise. We are character animators, not avant-garde artsy filmmakers, he often repeated with special emphasis. Cartoon animation in the late 1920s was an intensive handcraft, done with India ink on transparent celluloid sheets. To keep things straight, the individual cells, as they came to be called, were punched with two holes at the top which were placed on two stationary pegs. For each second that a cartoon ran, the animators had to create 30 images. To create a 6-minute cartoon required 10,800 images. The Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago completed 26 6-minute cartoons. That meant creating 291,000 images. The company had only 3 employees, one of whom operated the rostrum camera that shot photographic images of each cell. Another served as the company's secretary and also its bookkeeper. The 3 partners had only 1 tweener and artist who assisted the animators by doing the cells in between the major inflection points. Major studios like Walt Disney employed over 100 tweeners. For Avon, she had to do it all. It helped that she was nearly completely deaf, so she could concentrate on each individual cell. However, it was not unusual for her to work multiple, consecutive 12-hour days. The 3 partners also worked many multiple, consecutive 12-hour days, and they were very appreciative for Avon's help. However, when the company's finances began to tighten, she was released. Tweeners were always the most vulnerable employees in the animation industry. Lef Lehman, who always preferred to be Alec Lee, had gone to France in 1913 to study art. During his second year in Paris, the Great War began.
In a well of patriotic fervor, Lev Lehman volunteered for the newly formed French Air Corps Escadrille de Lafayette, where he served as a gunner in a 2-seat biplane. In June 1916, his plane was hit by ground fire over Douaumont, and Lev was seriously wounded, resulting in his leg being amputated below the knee.
Lef Lehman returned to his family's home in New York City, where, through family connections, he found a job as an art assistant for a well-known newspaper comic strip that ran daily in the Hearst papers. Within months, Lef's work caught the attention of the diabolical monster of early animation, Pat Sullivan.
The diabolical monster of early animation, Pat Sullivan. Pat Sullivan is proof of the adage that there is no connection between personal morality and talent. Sullivan was an Australian who attended an art college in Sydney for a year before sailing off to London to find fame and fortune. In London, he found work as an art assistant for a well-established newspaper cartoonist. There are stories of Sullivan's avarice even at the earliest stages of his career. He may have stolen money from his employer. Most certainly, he used his employer's name to charge expensive clothes, dining, and various niceties. As a result, he was fired. He next turned his attention to boxing and became a well-regarded lightweight who was known especially for his explosive left hook. He would use that punch many times during his career in animation. While still a professional boxer, he learned to dance and became a music hall performer. He may also have sung in a duet, but the evidence is not clear. What is clear is his extensive womanizing. What is also clear is his alcoholism. He once told friends that he had worked for a brewery as a night guard. It was there that he first gained his insatiable desire for alcohol. His employees reported that he was drunk every day. And Pat Sullivan was a mean drunk. Beating women. Hitting employees. Getting in frequent bar fights. Pat Sullivan left London suddenly, probably expecting to be arrested. In New York City, he again found work as an art assistant for the author of a newspaper comic strip. Soon, he was creating his own comic strips, stealing the characters and situations of his employer. This time, Sullivan was fortunate. The original author of the comic strip suddenly died, and the newspaper publisher told Sullivan to take over the strip. What people liked about Pat Sullivan's comic strip was his intense, penetrating humor and the simple clarity of his illustrations. That would remain his distinctive style as he transitioned from newspaper comic strips to animated cartoons. In 1914, Raoul Barre began what is best described as the first modern animation studio. He hired some of the best comic artists then working in New York City. One of his hires was Pat Sullivan. Pat Sullivan worked for Barre only for a few months before he was fired. However, he had worked there long enough to fully understand the processes of modern cell animation. While Sullivan was out of work, he learned that William Randolph Hearst wanted to enter the new business of cartoon animation. Sullivan applied for a position but was rejected. Then, Pat Sullivan decided to open his own animation studio. We do not know from where he acquired the money, but within weeks, he was hiring the same animators that Hearst had just hired, but at a significantly higher salary. So, in 1917, Sullivan Studios opened for business. Later that year, Lev Lehman was hired at Sullivan Studios as a part-time assistant artist. Lev, alacrity, had worked at the Sullivan Studios less than a year, when he was told that the business would be temporarily shutting down. Pat Sullivan had been convicted of raping a 14-year-old girl and was on his way to prison. When Pat Sullivan was released from prison, he reopened his animation studio and created the first superstar of animation, Felix the Cat. Some historians have concluded that Felix the Cat created the American animation film industry. In simple economic terms, that is completely true. Felix cartoons were shown in practically every movie theater on the planet. And Felix-inspired merchandise outsold all other toys. Felix's image was featured on many products, making him the perfect advertising spokesperson. During the 1920s, only Charlie Chaplin rivaled Felix's popularity. And Chaplin himself enjoyed the animated Cats films, replaying his favorites many, many times in his home theater. To meet the insatiable demand for Felix the Cat cartoons, Pat Sullivan created an animation factory where specific teams of artists worked only on specific components of a project. Many of the so-called masters from the later golden age of animation began their careers at the Sullivan Studios. That included Lev Lehman, who, professionally always signed his work as Alacrity. In November 1922, Pat Sullivan fired the kid with the wooden leg. It was not unusual for Pat Sullivan to fire employees. The smallest things would send him into a rage. What was different when he fired Alec Lee was that Pat Sullivan first hit Alec with his notorious left hook, knocking him unconscious. Alec Lee was sent flying across the room, crashing into drawing tables, ashtrays, and the water cooler. When Alec regained consciousness, he left the building, holding a wet towel over his bleeding mouth, never to return. Alec's fiancée Bernice would not let him go back. The next day, Pat Sullivan was angry because he could not find Alec Lee. He wanted to give him a special assignment. He loudly insisted to all who would listen that he had not fired the kid. I always felt sorry for him with his wooden leg and all. He was pretty good with a pen. Would never have fired him. Thank you.
The Lehman family had made its money in insurance, more specifically, fire insurance. Lev could have joined the company and could have become an executive with his own office and a defined role in the organizational chart. If he had joined the family's company, he would have had more than enough money to afford a lovely house, a good car, and the other nice things that Bernice wanted. But Lev Lehman did not want a career in fire insurance. He had caught the animation sickness. He wanted to be Alec Lee, principal cartoon animator. He had seen the magic that Felix the Cat brought, and he wanted to continue to be a part of making it happen. Bernice did not understand him. Cartoon animators were poorly paid. They worked long hours stooped over a desk. Bosses were terrible. Even the good ones kept harping about meeting deadlines. No one even knew what you did. You were completely anonymous. And, she argued, these animation companies were shaky operations, existing only if their cartoons were popular and disappearing when their cartoons were not. Bernice was right. It was a terrible career choice. The negatives far outstripped the positives. Take the job with your family's company. Paint and draw in your spare time. In the evenings and on weekends. We can even devote a room in our house to your art studio. Alec Lee did not hear Bernice. Instead, he found a job in Chicago drawing a weekly comic strip for one of the city's newspapers. Not animation, but still art with characters. Like Pat Sullivan, he believed, he could always grow his comic strip into a full-scale animation. Bernice promised to visit him in Chicago, but she never did.
In Chicago, Alec Lee happily settled into his new role as a newspaper cartoonist. His editor was pleased with the comic strip and even discussed syndicating it to other newspapers. However, the happiness only lasted 9 months. The Chicago newspaper was sold, and a new editorial team was brought in. Alec Lee was among the 50 employees given their walking papers. In Chicago and not wanting to take his family's assistance, Alec accepted a position as a catalog illustrator in Montgomery Ward's massive Chicago headquarters. The illustrations section created illustrations, demonstrating aspects of the products in the company's famous mail-order catalogs. For many products, an illustration was more informative than a photograph. It was not a creative position, but it did pay relatively well, and Montgomery Ward's was, in the mid-1920s, still America's leading retailer. In the illustrations section, Alec was the most junior illustrator, but was not the youngest in chronological age. The two illustrators sitting on either side of him were years younger than he was. Hugh Barton was only 27 but was the lead illustrator for the whole section. He had been working at Montgomery Ward since he was 16. Hugh Barton's forte was clean, precise illustrations centering on the features that the product managers wished to emphasize. To Alec, Hugh appeared to be a careful draftsman who took his time and meticulously duplicated the product's appearance. Alec worked quickly, almost impulsively. Hugh was never impulsive, but unlike Alec, he never had to redo a rendering. Hugh was recently married and was saving money to buy a house. Tall and muscular, Hugh looked like an athlete. Indeed, in his later years and living in California, he became an avid golfer, competing in pro-am tournaments and doing quite well. Charles Carter sat on the other side of Alec's drawing table. He reminded Alec of the men he had worked with at the Sullivan Studio. He understood how humans move and he created images that reflected that understanding. One of the special assignments that Charles performed so well was to transform a frumpy house dress into a design that women loved and bought. He did not change the basic design of the dress. No. It was still the same basic design. Just, after Charles had done his particular magic, it fit better. The way that he did it was much like the paper dolls that girls often played with. Montgomery Ward had, over the years, produced a large collection of photographs of attractive women wearing just the barest of essentials. Charles would take the dress that the product manager provided him and retrofit its image to fit the model in the photograph, dressing her, just like in Playing with Paper Dolls. The difference was that Charles used his understanding of human movement to make the catalog dress look natural, taking parts away or adding parts to enhance the look of the dress. No more frumpy house dress. It was now a lovely design that customers wanted. Charles had been to art school in Chicago, and he had often drawn live models. Like Alec, he worked quickly. His lines were firm and clear. Charles was also quick with a joke, finding humor in even the most mundane situation. Charles Carter was married with three children. He owned a house in Oak Park, where he occasionally joined the Montgomery Ward baseball team that played its games there. Three young artists working side by side in a large corporation. There was no creativity in what they did, but it paid well, and Montgomery Ward was a stable employer.
'27 was a banner year for Montgomery Ward. The Thorne brothers, who still operated the Mammoth Company, declared a paid, two-week vacation for all employees. When he learned about the two-week vacation, Alec offered to host his two colleagues and their families at the lodge that his family owned in Old Stone Mountain, Vermont. Each had brought their sketchbooks with them to the lodge. One afternoon, during a short rainstorm, the three friends sat together on the grand, covered porch and shared some of their most recent sketches. Charles had recently taken his children to the zoo, and his sketchbook was full of animal drawings. As always, Charles was adept at showing characters in motion. After sharing some of his drawings, he casually remarked that his children were more impressed with the organ grinder and his inquisitive monkey than they were with the large animals from Africa. He flipped a page and showed a drawing of a man with a large handlebar mustache wearing a soft, slouch hat turning the crank of a large hand organ. Alec was the first to react. "Wait a minute. That's perfect." Thinking he was talking about the organ grinder, Charles started to explain that he was wearing a red bandana around his neck and a checkered vest. "No, I mean the monkey. His expression is perfect. You know instantly that he intends some mischief. You can see it in his face." Hugh joined the conversation. "By Jiminy, I see what you mean. Jiminy. That's what we will call him. Jiminy the mischievous monkey." No one remembered who had said it. Most likely, it was a simultaneous realization that they all experienced. Alec Lee would later tell a story about how the monkey in Charles' original drawing leapt from the sketchbook and announced to the world that he was Jiminy the impetuous monkey. Alec was probably right.
"His expression is perfect. You know instantly that he intends some mischief. Jiminy. That's what we will call him. Jiminy the mischievous monkey." No one remembered who had said it. Most likely, it was a simultaneous realization that they all experienced. Alec Lee would later tell a story about how the monkey in Charles' original drawing leaped from the sketchbook and announced to the world that he was Jiminy the Impetuous Monkey. Alec was probably right. . 1927 had been a banner year for the venerable Montgomery Ward Company, and to celebrate its success, the company awarded its employees 2 weeks paid vacation. Yet, 1927 would be the last profitable year for the company until after the Second World War. Seeing the phenomenal success that its competitor Sears was having with its new retail stores, Montgomery Ward decided, in early 1926, to end its mail-order-only business and to open its own retail operations. It used all the substantial reserves that it had built up over the years to rapidly open retail stores that looked just like the ones that Sears was opening. By July 1929, Montgomery Ward's had opened over 500 retail stores, nearly matching the number of stores that Sears had opened. The problem was that its previous core business, mail order catalog sales, nosedived in 1928. Droughts, floods, insect infestations, and foreign competition had devastated many American farms. They no longer had money to buy things from the Ward's wish book. Without the substantial income from its mail order operations and having spent so much of its previous cash reserves on opening retail stores, the company was forced, for the very first time, to approach the New York banks about loans to purchase the merchandise it needed for the coming Christmas sales season. Unfortunately, the stock market crash of 1929 created a severe national credit crunch, and the New York banks demanded to see the company's books. Unfortunately, when the review was completed, it was found that the venerable company was fast approaching bankruptcy. J.P. Morgan, among others, demanded the removal of the company's governing board, appointing instead a hard-nosed turnaround bully to run the company. He made severe cuts to all of the company's operations, most notably to the mail order catalog staff. Lef Lehman and Charles Carter were both fired, and Hugh Barton had his salary reduced to one-third of what it had been. The funds to start the Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago came from two primary sources. First, Lef Lehman, Alec, sold some bonds that he had inherited years ago, and second, Charles Carter took a loan out on his house. The Carousel Cartoon Company of Chicago existed barely 4 years, making 26 six-minute cartoons. Like many such ventures, it was begun with great excitement and energetic commitment. Their work was drawing lines on transparent celluloid sheets with India ink. They had the remarkable ability to create an engaging and lively character with four strokes of a pen. However, those four strokes had to be repeated thousands and thousands of times to create an animated, moving and talking character. For each second that a cartoon runs, the animators had to create 30 images. To create a 6-minute cartoon required 10,800 images. To create the 26 cartoons that Carousel Cartoon completed required 291,000 cells. Remember, the company had only 3 employees, the camera operator, the tweener, and the secretary bookkeeper. So, Alec, Charles, and Hugh each drew thousands of cells. They also had to record music and sound effects for the talkie cartoons. And, they had to market and distribute their films. The large Hollywood animation factories used as many as 50 people to make a single 6-minute cartoon. It was skillful handwork that had to be completed on tight production timelines. The only way to speed things up was to assign additional artists, tweeners, colorists, photographers, and recording engineers to a project. Charles, Hugh, and Alec did not have the resources to hire additional staff. So, they did everything themselves. It required considerable personal energy and naive excitement to do the massive work they accomplished. Work they accomplished under extreme financial stress and difficult to achieve timelines. 26 cartoons. Unfortunately, today, almost no one knows of their work. Theirs was a small, regional studio creating black and white cartoons before the so-called golden era of animation. It was also a venture that did not endure. However, unlike other ventures that did not succeed, Carousel Cartoon had an influence on animation that is still apparent today. Charles Carter and Hugh Barton all became key Hollywood animation artists, directors, and designers. Almost no one today knows their names, but almost everyone knows their work. After they had to close their company, Hugh Barton joined Max and Dave Fleischer in their animation studios, working primarily as an animation director on their Popeye the Sailor and their Superman animations. Unlike Carousel Cartoon, the Fleischer studios were backed by a major Hollywood studio, Paramount Pictures, guaranteeing access to movie theaters across the whole country. For most of the 1930s, the Fleischer's Betty Boop was America's favorite cartoon character. One of the advantages of working for the Fleischer brothers was that they had moved their animation studios to Miami, where Hugh Barton was able to perfect his golf game. While Hugh went south to the warm Miami sun, Charles and Alec went west to Hollywood. Within days of their arrivals, each had a position working for one of the major studios. Charles Carter went to Warner Brothers, where his special expertise was adding realistic motion to the stable of Looney Tunes characters. A character would be brought to Charles, and he would create the keyframes necessary for animating the character's movements. Other animators would take his keyframes and finalize the animation sequence. In a typical day, he might work on 3 or 4 different Looney Tunes characters, making Bugs Bunny throw a baseball, or Daffy Duck do a meandering drunken walk. Charles was often simply called the movement guy. Alec Lee was hired by Walt Disney as one of his principal character designers. Alex's hand touched literally hundreds of Disney characters. Walt Disney never noticed it, but Alec often redrew early drafts of characters to have the features that he had put into his old Jiminy the Impulsive Monkey cartoons. As Alec drew him, the Jiminy character had a far greater range of human emotions than did the characters originally sketched by the other Disney artists. Moving 4 or 5 lines changed everything. Not once in all the years that Alec worked for Walt Disney did Disney ever reject a character rework that Alec did. Jiminy was easy to draw. Once a gag had been created, it was easy to place him into it. All of his creators reported that Jiminy practically drew himself. In 20 or 30 minutes, they would have a couple hundred cells, 3 or 4 seconds of animation. Amazing. On the other hand, drawing the organ grinder man was always tedious. He often had to be done multiple times to avoid making him too mean looking. They tried him with his handlebar mustache and without it. They gave him curly hair, then no hair. They made him plump and then skinny. Stood him with one leg forward, then erect. They tried to make him dance, but he would not do it. The gag that worked the best was the one where Jiminy is first the monkey with a cup in his hand collecting coins from the bystanders, then poof. He becomes the organ grinder and the man becomes the one forlornly collecting coins in a cup. The gag worked so well they decided to make it a feature in every Jiminy cartoon. Sometimes, they did it more than once, giving Jiminy different expressions each time. The audiences loved the gag. It was a fan favorite. Of course, the Jiminy cartoons had other gags. Jiminy would sneak into a very posh, upscale department store and then bounce around putting on the wigs from the various mannequins, eventually having 6 or 7 on his head. He went to a doctor's office and then chased the nurses around, holding a gigantic syringe. He rode horses in the Kentucky Derby, winning the race while hiding under the saddle. He was so easy to draw. He made every gag funny.
Jiminy was so easy to draw. He made every gag funny. Comedy was easy for him. That Jiminy was so easy to draw confirmed what Alec often claimed. He denied that the animators had created him. No. He would say that the artist brought the character to life, like a midwife brings a baby from its mother into life. He argued that Jiminy had his own anima, which in Latin meant soul or essence of being. The artist draws the ink lines, but the character supplies the anima. The character brings its own essence of being. To be emphatic, the artist did not create the character. Jiminy was always there, just waiting for his anima. Hugh and Charles, over time, came to agree.
Comedy was easy for him. That Jiminy was so easy to draw confirmed what Alec often claimed. He denied that the animators had created him. Jiminy was always there, just waiting for his anima. Hugh, Charles, and Alec each had important, but unrecognized, roles in the so-called golden age of cartoon animation. They were well paid and were respected members of the larger animation community. However, none of the projects on which they worked were their own. It was an assembly line process and each one did only their small, assigned part. Alec began, over time, to feel that his animation work lacked meaning. To be sure, the technology of animation was far superior to what they had done at the Carousel Cartoon Company. Animation had evolved into a genuine art form, and the Disney studios were creating lasting masterworks in full-length animated film. Still, he began to long for the time when his pen strokes were wholly his own. During the war years, non-essential travel was severely restricted, and Alec and his colleagues could not go to Vermont and sit on the covered porch of the old lodge. It was there, on that old covered porch, that Jiminy had first been born. Alec longed for the freedom and the excitement they had felt back then in Old Stone Mountain, Vermont. After the war, he traveled back. But he learned what was to him distressing news. The old lodge had been sold and a luxury, high-rise hotel was being built in its place. Alec felt betrayed. Yet, there was nothing he could do. The Lehman family no longer owned the property. It had been sold during the mid-1930s. Only now, in the post-war era, was it being developed. Since coming to California, Alec had lived in a small two-bedroom apartment just minutes from the Disney studios. He decided it was now time to buy property. He bought a very nice, contemporary home in the newly developing Van Nuys area, a home with over an acre of land. There in his backyard, he recreated the covered porch of the Old Stone Mountain Lodge. He added a pond and various trees and vegetation. The original Old Stone Mountain Lodge may not still exist, but he could visit his recreation anytime by just going out his back door. He would sit on his rebuilt porch with his sketchbook and create images of his own choosing. Most often, he would draw Jiminy. Jiminy in new poses. Jiminy in new situations. Jiminy in new places. Jiminy, the organ grinder's monkey, was as easy to draw as always. No doubt about. He was a character with anima. Some historians have argued that television killed the so-called golden age of animation. More particularly, they cite the Hanna-Barbera style of animation as the weapon that did the deed. Whereas classic animation drew 30 unique cells for each second of animation, the Hanna-Barbera studios drew only 10. Backgrounds were stripped to the barest minimums and smooth, natural movements were abandoned altogether. This was television animation. Small screens. Static perspectives. Animations produced quickly and then essentially discarded. Character voice became more important than a character's movement. When much of the actual production for television animation moved offshore to lower cost countries, it felt to many that an epoch had ended. In the early 1950s, Hugh Barton left the now dysfunctional and economically failing Fleischer Brothers studio and came west to join Disney. Even before he moved from Miami, he was already making most of his income from doing background matte paintings for Hollywood. Disney hired him to exclusively do backgrounds, especially for the studio's lush opening sequences. This work led to an interesting series of assignments related to the new theme park, Disneyland, that the company was designing. When he came to Hollywood, Hugh noticed that the animation industry was already in decline. He was not surprised that in 1957, his longtime colleague Charles was forced by Warner Brothers to retire. Looney Tunes was being reduced to a mere skeleton staff. Charles was fortunate. He found part-time work teaching animation courses at the University of Southern California Film School. In 1969, Disney forced both Alec and Hugh to retire. Both were well past the company's mandatory retirement age. However, both were given contracts as consulting artists for various Disney projects. Every Thursday afternoon, the three longtime colleagues gather in Alec's backyard and sit together on the recreated porch of the old Stone Mountain Lodge, drawing in their personal sketchbooks. Their Thursday sessions usually begin at 11, break for lunch at 2, and finish about 7. They talk and draw, suggest and criticize. They shape and reshape. They begin at 11 and end about 7. Every Thursday.
Here is a philosophical question that Lev Lehman used to ask himself. How old is old? Of course, he also asked the related question. How young is young? Every day, he gets up at 5:30, drives the 4 miles to the gym, and, on the treadmill, walks 6 miles at a brisk pace. The new state-of-the-art prosthesis really helps. Bicycles another 20 minutes. Lifts weights. Does 20 minutes of yoga, and then comes home to a nutritionist-designed breakfast. The last time he needed medical assistance was in 1963 when his appendix ruptured. He has a dog and a much younger girlfriend who comes over a couple of nights every week. He does not need glasses and has all his original teeth. A couple of times a month, he joins a conference call with some of the current generation of Disney animators to provide his input to their various projects. He also teaches a YouTube course about the techniques of effective 2D animation. Of course, he uses contemporary software technology which eliminates 90% of the grunt work that used to be needed for animation. With that said, this piece is written in 2022. It has been 100 years since Pat Sullivan hit Alec Lee with a killer left hook. Hugh Barton is practically as healthy as Alec. Just an occasional back twinge from too much golf. Charles had some health issues a while ago, but with good medical care and a better diet, things are much better. What is their magic that has produced such longevity?
It has been 100 years since Pat Sullivan hit Alec Lee with a killer left hook. It has been 100 years since Pat Sullivan hit Alec Lee with a killer left hook.
What is the magic that has produced such longevity?
What is the magic that has produced such longevity?
What is the magic that has produced such longevity?
Blame it on Jiminy. It is important to remember that Jiminy never really died. It is true that Jiminy no longer appeared in his own cartoons, and it is also true that no other Carousel cartoons appeared in movie theaters. However, Jiminy never died. He went into semi-retirement in a place he loved, Old Stone Mountain, Vermont. Alec Lee asked his grandfather for permission to store all the cells from the company in the three massive safes in the Old Stone Mountain Mutual Life Assurance Company offices. The Lehman family had begun in Old Stone Mountain as a mutual life insurance company during the 1840s. Only in the 1890s did they move operations to New York City and enter the more lucrative fire insurance business. They maintained the Vermont Mutual Life Insurance business because they were legally required to do so. In 1935, Alec, Hugh, and Charles packed the thousands of animation cells into sturdy, steel, fireproof boxes and drove them in a truck to the life insurance company offices. All three of the massive safes were in the same room on the second floor of the insurance company. Alec always liked that room. It had a large window providing a view of the mountain itself. "Jiminy can sneak out and see it any time he chooses," Charles joked. But they all knew that it probably was not a joke. They had given Jiminy the collection of simple India inclines, his own anima. Jiminy was now an independent entity with his own existence.
In 1935, Alec, Hugh, and Charles packed the thousands of animation cells into sturdy, steel, fireproof boxes and drove them in a truck to the life insurance company offices. All three of the massive safes were in the same room on the second floor of the insurance company. Alec always liked that room. It had a large window providing a view of the mountain itself. Jiminy was now an independent entity with his own existence. It was completely reasonable to say that he could sneak out of the insurance company safe and continue with his famous pranks. The Old Stone Mountain Mutual Life Assurance Company building had three floors. On the bottom level, the company's clerks worked, handling communications, paying commissions to the sales agents, and sending out bills to customers. At its peak, the company had about 30 clerks. By 1934, the number had been reduced to a mere handful. The company's second floor was used exclusively for the actuaries, and the third floor was the executive suite where the company's vice presidents and president had offices. The company's safes were on the second floor because that is where the secrets of the business were kept. There was no secret more important than the algebraic formula for the APD, the actuarially predicted death. The APD was how the Old Stone Mountain Mutual Life Assurance Company made its money. For each customer purchasing life insurance, the company would compute an APD. Life insurance pays out when the customer dies. It was important for the company to know when a policy was purchased how long the client would probably live. The company used the money that clients paid every month to make investments. It was important to predict how long a client might live, in order to charge them a rate sufficient to ensure the company made a profit from its investments before it had to pay the death benefit.
To compute the APD, the Old Stone Mountain Mutual Life Assurance Company used a straightforward algebraic formula. Input the client's current age, in months. Multiply that number by five separate factors, one for sex of client, one for family history, one for current health, one for occupation, and one for what was called special circumstances, which had been noted by the selling agent. Together, these factors would produce the client's APD in months. In 1935, when the animation cells from the Carousel Cartoon Company were packed into the safes, the Old Stone Mountain Mutual Life Assurance Company had only one woman serving as its actuary. Maggie had been a high school math teacher who joined the company because she no longer enjoyed teaching. Maggie liked her solitude on the second floor. She especially enjoyed her view of the old mountain itself. To do her work, to compute the APD for each new client, Maggie used a brass actuarial calculator that had been specially made for the company during the 1850s. The calculator was composed of 18 interlocking brass wheels, which when twisted produced the necessary calculations. Maggie could have solved the algebraic equation manually as she had taught her students to do. However, once she had fully tested the brass object, she was fully convinced of its accuracy. The clerks on the first floor would complete a 3x5 index card on each client and then drop them into a box for Maggie. She would take the information, calculate the APD, and then write the number in the space on the card. At the end of each day, she would deposit the cards she had completed in another box. Most days, she did not need to speak to anyone. The brass actuarial calculator was kept in its own fat-lined wooden box in the middle of Maggie's desk.
The brass actuarial calculator was kept in its own felt-lined wooden box in the middle of Maggie's desk. It took Jiminy a while, but he learned how to squeeze out of the safe by wiggling around the locking tumblers. Once out of the safe, he loved exploring the actuary office, looking out the window, sitting in Maggie's chair, drinking tea from her special cups. He did not understand what the shiny brass actuarial calculator was or how it worked.
He did not understand what the shiny brass actuarial calculator was or how it worked. Finally, he decided to sneak out during the daytime and to watch Maggie do her job. She twisted some of the wheels and then she wrote down a number. Interesting, he mused. But what does it mean? Jiminy was to find out what Maggie's numbers meant when in 1947, he was overjoyed to see his three incredible creators in the insurance company's actuary office. They were there because the old Stone Mountain Mutual Life Assurance was being merged with another Lehman company and all operations were being moved to New York City. The three animators were in the actuary office to decide what to do with the animation cells stored there. It was in that conversation that Jiminy learned of Charles' recent heart attack. He heard how Charles had been rushed to the hospital in an ambulance, about the nitroglycerin pills that Charles carried, about Charles' worries about caring for his family. Jiminy had always thought of the three animators as them. Them. The ones who were always there. The ones he played tricks on by doing things as he wanted, not as they had planned. Now he was worried. His pleasant semi-retirement in the actuary office would not be fun if Charles or Hugh or Alec were not there. He needed them. Not just to draw him, not just to apply then pen strokes that made him real. No, he needed them because he cared for them. They were, he realized, like his family.
In the new company, the one into which Old Stone Mountain Mutual Life Assurance would be merged, all the actuarial computations would be done by computing machines with tubes and wires and punch tape. No need for either Maggie or the brass actuarial calculator. Everything, it was planned, would be cleared out. Time to be modern, to function like the other companies did. So, Alec, you, and Charles were in the former actuary office trying to decide what to do with their animation cells. They could ship them all to California where they now lived and store them there. Or, maybe they should get rid of the lot. Cartoon animation had changed significantly since they were first created. No one did work in black and white anymore. Some of the carousel cartoons had a soundtrack, but it was recorded on much more primitive equipment and sounded tinny.
But, they felt as Jiminy did. They were all a part of the same family. Alec laughed and then said, "Let's ask Jiminy." He sat at Maggie's special desk, and with his sketch pad and pencil, began to draw the familiar lines of Jiminy and his organ grinder. By his fourth sketch, he had Jiminy's answer. The playful monkey wanted to stay where he was, in this special room with its view of Old Stone Mountain. He did not want to go to California. Sure, it was nice, with all that sun and those beautiful Hollywood starlets. However, his preferences were to stay here, even if the insurance company moved. Having Jiminy's answer, Lev Lehman asked his great uncle to give him the old building. No need to try fixing it up and selling it. Lev would take it as it is. His great uncle agreed. Alec Lee turned the third floor of the old building into an apartment that he used when he vacationed in Vermont. He turned the first floor into commercial retail space. First it was a beauty shop, then a furniture store, then a bookstore, and most recently a yoga studio. However, he kept the second floor exactly as Maggie had left it, not changing a thing.
It was there that Jiminy performed his special magic, magic that his creators always knew that he had. His monkey magic used the venerable brass actuarial calculator and the collection of 3x5 cards still stored in the old company safes. There was no need to take either to the new company. Computer punch cards and computing machines had taken over all data records. Worried about Charles' health, Jiminy began his search among the thousands of cards still in the safe. Finally, after much searching, he found Charles Stephen Carter, age 377 months, living in Chicago, occupation artist, with a significant history of family health issues. The policy was issued in March 1931. One of Maggie's predecessors had computed an APD for Charles Stephen Carter of 691 months. He was predicted to die at 57.58 years of age. He always smoked his pipe as he worked. No exercise. Stressful job. Overweight. Family health issues. He was already experiencing heart issues. Charles had been predicted to live only slightly more than 3 more years. Jiminy was worried. That is when his magic began to really work. He opened the wooden box holding the brass actuarial calculator. He turned some wheels. Now an APD of 84 months. Much better, 70.6 years. He twisted it again. 91.3 years. Again, and again and again. Finally stopping at 173.9 years. Then he found Hugh's card and followed the same process. Also 173.9 years. Finally, for Lev. Alec was also given an APD of 173.9 years. Monkey magic indeed. Thank you.
A Palooza Springs Audio Theater is a creative collaboration whose purpose is to write, produce, and share original story content through webcast radio experiences.